Welcome to SLP Nerdcast. I'm Kate.
And I'm Amy, and we appreciate you tuning in. In our podcast, we review and provide commentary on resources, literature, and we discuss issues related to the field of speech-language pathology.
You can use this podcast for ASHA CEUs. Visit our website for other courses, including live courses, webinars, blog posts, and SLP masterclasses available for graduate-level credit. SLP Nerdcast is committed to improving continuing education in our field through affordable pricing and open access libraries. You can support our work by leaving a review, referring a friend, making a one-time contribution on our website, or subscribing. You can subscribe for as low as $7 a month and get access to monthly Q&A sessions, exclusive content, discounts, and a resource library of downloads, freebies, and printables. Want unlimited access to ASHA CEU courses? There's an affordable subscription for that, too. For more information, visit us on our website or contact us anytime on Facebook, Instagram, or at info@slpnerdcast.com. We love hearing from our listeners, and we can't wait to connect with you.
And just a quick disclaimer, the contents of this episode are not meant to replace clinical advice. SLP Nerdcast, its hosts and guests do not represent or endorse specific products or procedures mentioned during our episodes unless otherwise stated. We are not PhDs, but we do research our material. We do our best to provide a thorough review and a fair representation of each topic that we tackle. That being said, it's always likely that there's an article that we've missed or another perspective that we haven't shared. If you have something to add to the conversation, please email us. We love hearing from our listeners.
We have such an interesting topic to talk about today. We are here to discuss dysphagia or dysphagia. The jury's still out for me on which pronunciation is accurate. And telehealth, which just sounds so interesting. And as our listeners know, Amy and I work clinically in the field of AAC. So we brought in our dysphagia correspondent today. We asked our coworker and fellow Nerdcast member, Tracy Callahan, to join us. Welcome, Tracy.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here.
We're excited to have you so that you can elevate this conversation. And I know it's going to be really, really great. We're also very excited to welcome Dr. Georgia Malandraki. Welcome, Georgia.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. You are here to discuss swallowing and telehealth. Before we get started, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a speech language pathologist, just like you guys as well. And I'm a board certified specialist in swallowing disorders, but I'm also an associate professor in speech language and hearing sciences at Purdue University, where I have developed the Purdue IEAT lab. It is a lab that deals with the study of swallowing physiology and neurophysiology across the lifespan. And a secondary focus, which has become a rather primary focus in the last few years, and definitely since the pandemic started, has been the area of telehealth as well. So I'm very excited to be here today and to be discussing this topic with all of you.
I have so many questions. I know we all do. But before we get into the good stuff, the powers that be require that I read aloud our learning objectives as well as our financial and non-financial disclosures. So if you're listening, I'm sorry that this is a required piece. ASHA makes me read it. So stick with us and we will get to the good stuff in a minute. Learning objective number one, describe basic regulatory guidelines for the safe use of telemanagement of dysphagia. Learning objective number two, identify basic practical and clinical guidelines for the safe use of telemanagement of dysphagia. Learning objective number three, summarize the research evidence available for the use of telehealth for dysphagia management. And learning objective number four, describe new developments in wearable technologies for the telemanagement of dysphagia. Disclosures, Georgia's financial disclosures. Georgia is an employee of Purdue University and receives a salary and grants to support her work. Georgia also receives grants from the National Institute of Health related to work in telehealth. Georgia is the co-founder of a Purdue-initiated startup. Georgia's non-financial disclosures, Georgia is a member of and the president-elect of the Dysphagia Research Society. She is also the Indiana Speech and Hearing Association co-chair of the Telehealth Task Force. Kate, that's me. I'm the owner and founder of Grandbois Therapy and Consulting LLC and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. My non-financial disclosures, I'm a member of ASHA SIG 12 and serve on the AAC Advisory Group for Massachusetts Advocates for Children. I'm also a member of the Berkshire Association for Behavior Analysis and Therapy, MassABA, the Association for Behavior Analysis International, and the corresponding Speech Pathology and Applied Behavior Analysis Special Interest Group.
Amy, that's me. Financial disclosures. I'm an employee of a public school system and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. And my non-financial disclosures are that I'm a member of ASHA of SIG 12, and I also serve on the AAC Advisory Group for Massachusetts Advocates for Children.
Hi, I'm Tracy. I am an employee of SLP Nerdcast. I own a private practice and I'm the owner of an online learning platform called Guest Monster Games. My non-financial disclosures, I'm a member of ASHA and the corresponding special interest group, SIG 13 for dysphagia. I'm also a certified lactation counselor through the Academy of Lactation Policy and Practice.
All right, we've made it. Thanks for sticking with us, listeners.
It's so long. We try to make it shorter every time, but we just can't. But here we are on the other end.
On the other end. Georgia, could you start us off by telling us a little bit about that first learning objective? What are the rules? How can people be safe around a telemanagement of dysphagia?
Yeah, then this is a good question. It's a good first question as well, because a lot of times clinicians tend to want to know about how can I do it clinically without necessarily looking at kind of the prerequisites before you look at clinical effectiveness or clinical adaptations. And I consider some of the regulatory guidance a little bit as a prerequisite. So before you start thinking about clinical adaptations, I think it is important to think about laws and regulations that surround, for example, patient privacy and confidentiality, which is one of the biggest risks whenever you use the internet. So whenever you use telehealth, that's one of the added risks that we have to address. And when we talk about dysphagia management specifically, a lot of clinicians also have safety concerns about their patients. So by abiding by regulatory laws and guidelines, you're actually also protecting yourself or mitigating some of the safety concerns and risks as well. So things like, as I said, making sure that you abide by privacy and confidentiality laws, you know, for hospitals and clinical settings, the HIPAA law, the FERPA law when we're talking about schools. But also in addition to kind of this federal law, some states or even facilities may have their own regulations or statutes that you need to be aware of. So that's another thing that you need to explore. So depending on the state you work in or the facility you work in, it is important to investigate, talk to your risk management team maybe, or do legal counsel if you cannot find the information by yourself. Talk to your state association or licensure board about what are some of the guidelines that may be state specific or facility specific for you. And then making sure that you abide by them. And I know that sounds very vague, but in reality, there are two ways to abide by those types of guidelines. One is by taking technical defenses, meaning making sure that you are using a secure platform, making sure you're using a secure storage space, secure network. And, you know, and these are things that hopefully an IT person or IT teams can help with. And then the second pathway to secure that you are abiding by these regulations is to ensure that you have a consenting process in place. So both ASHA and the American Telemedicine Association, as well as state associations, highly recommend that you have a consenting process in place. I personally prefer a written consenting process, but even, you know, in some facilities and states, even a verbal consenting process is fine. So irrespective of what you will be using, I think it is important that you let the patients know about the risks, the benefits, your qualifications to use this new service delivery model for many people, right? And also what steps you have taken to mitigate any of these risks. And once the patient hears those, if they accept to continue, that's going to be up to them. So I think those are the primary, very, very now, in a very summarized overview way, right? These are some of the basic regulatory things that we need to think about at first. So privacy and confidentiality laws, the consenting process, technical defenses, licensure requirements as well. That's another, a third thing that we need to think about depending on, you know, the state we work in. A lot of licensure laws have been relaxed during the pandemic, but that doesn't mean that all states allow interstate, you know, practices. So you also, that's something you also have to check with your state licensure board. And ASHA has some really great resources. I'm happy to provide some of these links if you guys don't have them already for your audience. But they have some really great and constantly updated resources that they give for each state in terms of licensure. And then, of course, the other regulatory thing you have to consider is reimbursement. which is not negligible, as you all know, I'm sure, right? That has probably been the biggest hurdle. And again, I don't want to sound like an ASHA fanatic, but I do want to say that because of ASHA's efforts this past year and some of the state association's efforts as well, we finally were able to overcome, at least temporarily, some reimbursement hurdles as well. So things are a little better. We're still fighting to make things better for the future as well. So I would say those three big things are, you know, privacy, confidentiality, licensure, and reimbursement. So those are kind of the regulatory things that you need to keep in mind and investigate before you jump into the actual service delivery and usage of it.
And I think one thing that's really exciting is that we're able to continue to provide services to patients that really need it, because just because there's a pandemic doesn't mean that people don't need dysphagia therapy. So I think that it's been a really useful tool for those of us maybe who didn't use it before, but now I find that I really like it. It's a really, really great tool.
That's great to hear. I've heard mixed things from clinicians. You know, some people like you really love it and want to continue using it. I would say probably at least half of the clinicians I talk to are belong in this category, but there are still a few that either very negative or they don't really know, unsure, you know. So I think it is a challenge for us to persuade more people towards all the positive things that can happen with the use of telehealth. And you're right, a lot of people can be very much helped, irrespective of where they live or their ability to move and their ability to come to you.
Exactly. A lot of the patients that I see either live in a more rural area and the transportation is very difficult for them to coordinate, or physically the commute itself into a clinic is so taxing that by the time they get there, that they can't really do their best work. So I think it's a great tool and I'm excited to continue to use it.
So I have an obvious question. So we are talking about telehealth as an overarching modality or service delivery model. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously, you know, the person on the other side of the Zoom screen can present with any myriad of, you know, this, you know, articulation, thinking of like the classic speech therapy scenarios where your client or patient is engaged and looking at the camera and you're able to create some sort of therapeutic environment two-dimensionally. Mm-hmm. So, and again, this is not my area, but when I think of dysphagia, mm-hmm. I think of how physically hands-on it is. And I think of the risk of aspirating and how I'm not there to give the Heimlich, or I don't know, there just seems like this extra super scary component. So you already have this service delivery model of telehealth, which is really different and challenging in a lot of ways, but then you add dysphagia onto that. And I'm very intimidated by this even as an idea, and it's not something I do clinically. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think, thank you for asking that question. That's probably the most common question I get. So I will answer to the safety part first, because I feel like that's kind of the core of your question. And then let me know if I left anything out and I'll try to address the first part as well. What I want to say about safety, I understand, I partly understand these concerns, but I do understand, especially when they come from somebody who hasn't been doing this in a regular basis. So I think for those of us who have been treating patients in a regular basis, in in-person settings I'm talking about now, you know, we all know that during any session, okay, even if it is delivered in person versus telehealth, you know, whatever the service delivery model is, in any session that involves oral trials of foods and liquids, there's always a chance that a patient with dysphagia may aspirate, or in rare instances may even choke. But there is no evidence to suggest that that risk is in any form higher during a session with a dysphagia clinician, an expert, versus during their everyday life when they eat and drink. There's no research that shows us that. And in addition to that, there's no research that shows us that during a dysphagia telesession, the risk is higher than during a dysphagia in-person session. So I think this fear is a little bit exaggerated. So if you ask a dysphagia clinician, how many times did you have to do the Heimlich in an in-person session. I guarantee you, it's probably, unless they're working with a very specific, very, you know, severe type of population, it wasn't very frequent, right? Or it was extremely rare, the situations were that. I don't know, Tracy, if you have an answer once. Okay. Yeah. So I would argue that just like in in-person sessions, in telehealth sessions, we are the professionals who can actually mitigate those risks. So for example, we are the ones who can decide, is it safe for this person to have oral trials? How can we make things safer? Can we have them perform oral care right before we start the oral trials? Can we choose what we are going to give them, the amounts and the volumes? This is something it's up to us to decide. And then in addition to those things, having a facilitator present is a very important thing when you are doing oral trials, especially with patients that you believe are at risk for aspiration. So there are some safety things that you can do, having a safety plan in place, which is actually usually a safety plan should be in place for all types of telesessions, not just for dysphagia telesessions. And it's a plan that basically just says, what are we gonna do in the case of an emergency? So if you're not there to perform the Heimlich, so what will happen? So you have to have a safety plan in place that both the patient and their caregiver, or their aide or whoever is there with them, will have agreed to in the beginning of the session. This is typically part of the consenting process. So that has to be very clearly delineated. It's very similar to you and I being certified in CPR. That's a safety plan of the hospital and the clinic we work in, right? To be certified so that we can address an emergency situation. When you're not there, you have to have another safety plan in place. So that is important to have. But at the same time, I want to make sure that people understand that I don't want people to be so fearful of aspiration, first of all. Aspiration will happen. It happens with all of us, and it is what it is. Patients with dysphagia are at high risk for aspiration. Choking, of course, is something to try and prevent, of course, as much as possible. And that's why I'm saying we are the clinicians to decide what will happen in the session, how it will happen, when to stop, how to mitigate those risks as much as possible. Does that make sense? I think, Tracy, you had a question.
Yeah. And when thinking about what we do for our dysphagia therapy that we would do in person,
yes,
it's very similar. Yes. So if I have a patient who is at a high risk for aspiration, I'm going to do oral care first, not just because it's on telehealth, you know? And I found as I was doing more telehealth that there were a lot of more similarities than I initially thought. We would pick oral trials, what order we would do them in, the amounts that we would pick, the foods that we would pick. All of those things we would do in telehealth, we would also do if we were doing in-person therapy as well.
Yes, exactly. And I think that kind of answers partly the first part of Kate's question about, you know, I'm not there to, you know, to touch the patient. I don't have, you know, that fear that, you know, you're not next to the patient or you know, that's something that a lot of people are concerned about as well. But the reality is, as Tracy just mentioned, that a lot of the procedures we do are actually very hands-off. So for parts of what we do, we may need to touch the patient. You know, when you do tracheostomy care, in TEP, things like that, you need to touch the patient. Or you need, if you are going to do telehealth, you need to have somebody who is knowledgeable on the other end and you are really counseling them on how to do specific things, right? So those types of procedures definitely require facilitators that have extensive training, if not clinicians, actually, not just facilitators, right? But for most procedures of the clinical assessment or teletreatment, we don't need to touch the patient. You know, it used to be believed that you need to do laryngeal palpation. Well, there was work that came out of the University of Wisconsin a few years ago that said that laryngeal palpation is 50% accurate. You know what that means? That means that the fact that if I use laryngeal palpation to identify a swallow, is by chance accurate. Sometimes I will identify it and sometimes not. And actually I would argue that with telehealth, because you know there are things you can do like putting a tape on the thyroid notch, moving the camera on an angle that you can see really well, moving the camera really close to the head and neck in a diagonal way. I can actually visualize the swallow sometimes. I feel better than I could in person sometimes. Not with all patients, of course. There is variation, but But definitely, you know, I had stopped using laryngeal palpation the last few years anyway, so I don't use it now. I don't feel that I'm missing anything. There are things you can definitely, it's better to do them in person, or you can get more information in person than you could get via telehealth. So there are definitely some things that you can do as well. But I think the majority of the items that we examine in a clinical assessment, and the majority, not all, but the majority of things that we do in treatment can actually be done, are very feasible, and we are finding through our research that are also reliable.
That was going to be my next question about the research. So, I mean, I feel like, you know, our familiarity with telehealth has increased dramatically over the last year because we were so, you know, we were thrown into it. I have to assume that even just given advances in technology, the research on dysphagia and telehealth is somewhat recent. So what can you tell us about the evidence that's out there?
Yeah, actually, the reality is that a lot of research that we did have a lot of research evidence even before COVID-19 on the use of telehealth for dysphagia. A lot of that research was primarily focused on the reliability and validity of doing clinical teleassessments and how comparable they are with in-person clinical assessments. And the findings were pretty good, rather positive. And a lot of that research came out of Australia, which is a massive country, very big country, and a lot of rural areas. So they and they don't have the reimbursement hurdles that, or the licensure restrictions that we have. So they have been using telehealth for quite a while. So most of it was international research. We had also offered some research locally here in the US and some across international borders that showed that also that both clinical teleassessments and video fluoroscopy assessments are also feasible and reliable via telehealth when compared to in-person assessments. Yes.
That's so surprising.
Oh, yeah. So there are research papers out there. I have at least three or four publications on that topic. And telefluoroscopy publications, we have at least two or three on this topic. The issue has been, I think, the reason why this research has never really been translated into clinical practice in the US and in most countries across the world, I believe has been, I mean, there are many reasons, but I think the main reasons relate to, you know, the very strict regulations that we've had in this country. The other reason that I think is something for us researchers to think about more, and I think we now have thought about it a lot during COVID and have started acting on it, relates to the fact that most of research is done under very well-controlled research conditions. So it's not as easily clinically translatable. You know, like some of the studies that we were doing, we were using specialized cameras and specialized, very expensive equipment and pan and tilt and zoom cameras and echo canceling microphones and, you know, special headphones and echo canceling, I mean, headphones and, you know, and special microphones and, you know, a lot of specialized types of equipment. We had very expensive infrastructure. We spend a lot of time doing trainings of facilitators, that all the trainings were in person. So a lot of things that clinicians do not have available in their clinics. So it's very difficult. Even if the regulations were out there, it would have been a very difficult direct translation of the research. So that's I think, another hurdle that we had to overcome. And then I think the third piece, which I now I'm understanding how important it is after having talked to probably hundreds of clinicians in the past year, I would say, on this topic, is that fear that you explained earlier, that fear of aspiration, of choking, of not being close to the patient, which I'm hoping we've persuaded the audience that it's not a, I don't want to say it's not a logical fear, I understand it, but it's not, it's a little bit of an exaggerated fear that I think with training and knowledge, it's a fear that can be overcome and with adequate preparation. But I think there were those other two problems, and that's why that research was not clinically translated yet. Now, what I want to add here is that during the pandemic, I think we all realized, I mean, researchers that have done this work before as well, we all realized that we need to try and build the evidence under today's conditions. And actually, today's conditions, the pandemic conditions, are much more naturalistic. Meaning, you know, the first few months of the pandemic, we were confined in our homes, the clinicians. The patients were confined in their homes, right? We wanted to keep providing services. So the only way to do it was to do it with whatever technology was available, whatever internet connectivity was available, providing all the training online because that's all we had, right? And see how it works. And we have some data that we got one of our papers that was published a few months ago was a collaborative study with Dr. Michelle Trocha from Columbia University, New York City, that one of her PhD students led and showed in a small scale, of course, because it was a proof of concept study, that even under very variable conditions, clinical teleassessments were still feasible and were still reliable, even during today's conditions. So that type of research we need more of. We are continuing it, and I'm hoping that other teams are following as well, because we need more evidence under naturalistic conditions so that people can translate it clinically in a more rapid way.
This is fascinating.
Well, and we've talked a lot on here. We've had a lot of researchers on across the field and kind of talking about that need. So it's really exciting to hear that that's something that's already happening with dysphagia. And I think that also that type of real world naturalistic research is going to help make maybe some of those hesitant clinicians feel a little bit better too, because it's not just, you know, with these optimal conditions, it's a bit more akin to like what you're actually dealing with as a clinician who's just treating in natural contexts. I wonder if another, this is a nice segue into talking about wearable technologies for telemanagement. I didn't know that this was a thing prior to working on these learning objectives. I'm super curious about this and maybe the number one, what are they? But number two, how might that help support a clinician who is providing teleservices in this domain?
Yeah, no, thank you for the question. So first of all, wearable technologies are, you know, any type of, you know, technologies that you can wear, you know, it could be your smartwatch or some other specialized devices that are specifically designed for a medical reason that can monitor different types of data, biological data, biophysical data, and then transmit that data through a cloud server or by you sending the device back to the clinician, to your clinician for further interpretation and further guidance. So we had seen, even before the pandemic, the initial development of different apps that people could use at their home setting, for example, to monitor adherence of different exercises. So that's not new. That was happening even before the pandemic, and those apps are available for people to purchase, most of them. I believe some of them may be free, some of the simplest ones. So that was one possibility for patients that was even available even before the pandemic. Now, also, there have been several devices that have been developed in the past few years. For example, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the IOVA Oral Performance Instrument, which is a device that you can measure tongue strength and you can do tongue exercises with. It is a rather pricey device, but it is a device that has a patient.
There's some like biofeedback information on that.
Yes, yes. And there are, what I was going to say is there are two devices. The one is for the clinician and one is for the patient that they can take home. It is still, even the patient device is not cheap, is not economical. So that's one consideration that we have to think about. But those types of devices now connect to a cloud server so that the data that are collected at the home setting can be transmitted to the clinician via those cloud servers. And there are similar devices out there as well. So this is an area that we have been very interested in since I started working here at Purdue. We have been able to develop with some collaborators a couple of different wearable technologies. The first one that is closer to commercialization is a wearable surface electromyography device. It's kind of like a sticker device that goes on the neck and can monitor muscle activity when the patient is performing their exercises. The device is connected through a wireless unit to an app or a software on your computer or your phone that gives you biofeedback, just like the IOPA, as we talked about earlier. And so the patient can actually see in real time how they're doing their exercises. And then the data are also transmitted to the clinician through a cloud server for further review and interpretation. Now, a lot of these devices, like the ones that I've been talking about, we have been developing, are under development, so they're not available yet. But definitely, I believe the future is bright. There are other wearables out there with similar capabilities. So they give the capability to collect some data at the home setting and transfer the data to the clinician for further review. And I think that that is the advancement and further development of these types of devices is not only good for telehealth. I think it is important for in-person care as well. A lot of the treatments we have been doing with patients do not involve the use of biofeedback necessarily, or do not involve the use of accurate and reliable biofeedback. You know, it's different when you use a mirror or a tongue depressor, you know, that doesn't really provide an accurate read of the behavior, and very different when you actually use some objective data. We need to be moving more as a profession to collecting more objective data during treatment and during evaluations, of course, in general. And I would say that, that's a very good advancement for both the in-person and the tele management of dysphagia.
And then just to comment on that, what's great about having that data is that it can be really helpful for not only patients and for the clinicians, but also like caregivers. It's good for everybody to see that there's progress being made, that, you know, that it is increasing. Some of these you can chart and see progress with a graph, which can be really rewarding. So sometimes when doing these different exercises, it can be a little bit boring, but having that type of feedback and taking that kind of data can be a really helpful tool to help encourage the patient or person to kind of press on with the exercises and activities.
Yeah, absolutely. It has actually been found that the use of exercises improves adherence for sure. At the same time, if as a field, we want to move forward to a less symptomatic treatment approach and a more physiological treatment approach, we need to be using exercise physiology principles. And those principles are telling us that we need to be working towards targets. If we don't have targets, you will only be able to improve the patient to a specific level, and then that will be it. You will get a plateau very quickly. So I think that's another very important reason to continue working in this domain of developing more and more accurate and also affordable devices, because I think that's the biggest problem. The biggest problem is because this is a very small market compared to, you know, markets of other things that, you know, make a lot of money for people. Unfortunately, these devices end up being very costly. And right now, not many of them, if any, are reimbursable. So these are hurdles that we have been working on, and we need to be working on more.
I know that Kate and Amy both really love data. Data is probably one of their favorite things.
So it's
devices that are able to provide really specific and objective data, I think are wonderful. But also when we think about when we're doing therapy, to know the improvement is there, other than just they were able to swallow X number of bites over 3 sessions, you know, it's good to have some measurable numbers.
Absolutely. Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about any specific adaptations that, so I'm just thinking about a clinician who might be listening to this, who has experience doing this kind of treatment in person and is interested, maybe they live in a rural area or they're interested in exploring telehealth. What are some of the specific adaptations that a clinician, a practicing clinician, might need to consider when setting up telehealth for maybe the first time or the fifth time or the 10th time?
Yeah. So first of all, I would say just to make sure I repeat it enough, that all these, the prerequisites that we talked about the regulatory guidelines, the infrastructure and all of those things, those need to come first, and all those considerations. And once those have been taken care of, I think there are actually relatively simple, but a little bit time consuming adaptations that people can do. Meaning, I think the biggest thing that you need to understand and do is that you will need some time to prepare materials. You know, in telehealth, unlike in in-person services, most of the times you need to make sure that the patient has the list of items you need them to have in front of them before the session starts. You know, in the clinic, you can grab something if you forget something. Usually you have pockets, right, full of stuff, or drawers full of stuff. So you can easily, you know, choose something else or have a plan B of what you want to try or how you want to do things. With telehealth, you have to be pretty well prepared for both plan A and plan B. So that's the biggest thing. So I would say you need to spend some time in the beginning, if we're talking just about clinical adaptations, for example, to maybe prepare some online materials or purchase some online materials. There's so many things nowadays available. Create online forms and use secure platforms to deliver those forms. You know, case history forms, or, you know, things like you may be using the E10 as a, or other quality of life instruments. You may be using the MoCA or other, you know, cognitive screens, whatever, you know, whatever you use, you will need to make sure that you're using the appropriate electronic form if you're going to be transferring into an electronic or a remote environment only. So that those types of things need a little bit of preparation. So that's, I think that's something that clinicians need to think a little bit about more. Also, you know, in terms of the items that you will need in the clinical assessment. So what we have done is we have prepared like very cheap telehealth kits, and we usually send a list of items to the patient. And if they cannot collect all the items that we believe are necessary, then we will consider sending them that very small telehealth kit so that they can have the items we need them to have in front of them in case they didn't have them at the home setting. At the same time, you need to be a little flexible because they may have something similar to what you wanted to try, but not exactly what you wanted to try. So you can decide how flexible you want to be. And again, this takes a little bit of preparation and communication beforehand. So there is some initial time that has to be spent. The good thing, I think, and those of you who have done telehealth, you know this well, is that once you prepare well, once, you usually have material for quite a few more patients, right? So of course you need to make adaptations and you need to change a few things and a few of your stimuli and things like that. But especially for dysphagia care, things are relatively standard. Of course, the way you do things change, but typically the types of things you do are not that different. And they're not there's not an exhaustive list that you can't really possibly prepare materials for most of it. So I think preparation is a big thing. And then when it comes to the actual clinical application, the important thing is to be able to have the materials you need and to be able to see and hear well what you need to see and hear. So you have to check to make sure that the internet connectivity is adequate. And this is something that we extensively talk about in some of the webinars I gave for ASHA, and also some of the papers, that the guidance papers that we published this past year. So for those of you who are interested in learning more about it, and testing then, you know, as I said, the internet connectivity and the technology that the patient has to make sure that you have the adequate audio and video for what you need to see and hear. When it comes to the actual, you know, down to the day where you actually have to do the assessment, simple things, for example, like moving, I think I mentioned earlier, like moving the head diagonally and moving the camera close to the patient so that you can see the head and neck well, putting a tape on the thyroid notch helps with visualization of the swallows. It's not perfect, but it can be helpful. Making sure that you use clear cups. And I like to use measuring cups so that I can see how much volume is being consumed as well of the different materials. You know, simple things like that can actually enhance the process really well. The other thing I really like using, especially for swallows or any type of oral trials that the patient is doing, I like having a second camera. And by second camera, I don't mean going out and purchasing an expensive, you know, second external camera. But actually what we have been using during the pandemic, which we didn't believe it would work, but it worked really well, is just using a phone. So we would send the Zoom healthcare link to the facilitator, the caregiver, and they would also connect to the session as an extra participant through their phone. They would use that camera with our direction as a close-up camera. So, you know, I could see the patient from their regular camera in the front view, and then I would have the caregiver's or facilitator's phone providing me the lateral views, the diagonal views, the views inside the mouth, you know, things like that. So a simple solution like that, that really came out of necessity. We didn't know what else to use during the pandemic to make things more visible for us and better to visualize things better. And we tried it, and it actually works much better than some of the pan tilt and zoom cameras I was using a few years ago when I was doing telefluoroscopies. So it's you know, technology has advanced so much in the last few years, and it's becoming more of our friend now in the area of telehealth. So, you know, those simple things, I would say, and I'll probably mention too many, but just to get an idea.
No, more information is always better. There's no such thing as too many things. I'm wondering about the requirement of a facilitator, and you've mentioned caregivers a few times. Is this an adaptation or something that's different that you feel is a requirement first, or does the evidence say that it's a requirement for successful dysphagia intervention over telehealth?
We don't have definitive evidence that says that it is absolutely necessary or not. We do have evidence that says that facilitators can get trained and can be very helpful. What I would tell you based on my experiences is that for clinical assessments, I consider a facilitator, I make it a requirement that a facilitator is present, because there are many parts in the clinical assessment. Like, for example, I want to try and test sensory responses. I want to try as part of the cranial nerve examination, or I want to try and test strength responses to the best of our ability, of course. So the use of a facilitator for these types of things is very important. In addition to, of course, as I said earlier, it you know, it can be part of the safety plan. So it can give me peace of mind. So for clinical teleassessments, I do find them necessary, and I personally require them in our clinic. For teletreatment sessions, there could be situations that they're not absolutely necessary, but I think that will depend highly on the age of the patient, their cognitive status, their general health status, and very importantly, on what has been decided as the safety plan and agreed upon as the safety plan. Because if your safety plan says that there will be a facilitator there, and that is what the patient has agreed to, then you need to have a facilitator present. But that's not necessarily required if that's not what the safety plan says. So it a lot depends on all these other factors, plus the safety plan as well. And one thing I want to mention, it's not related to facilitators, but because I feel like I'm talking about teleclinical assessment and teletreatments, and I'm not talking about instrumental assessments at all. I don't want people to think that I believe that we don't need instrumental assessments by any means. They're a very big part of what we do, very, very important. Right now, there are ways to use telehealth for instrumental assessments, but those ways are either very expensive. And, you know, for example, for televideo fluoroscopy, you need to get buy-in from radiology as well to buy specialized equipment to do that. And in addition to that, they're not assessments that you could do from the home setting, you know? So until we develop that X-ray.
I was trying to picture what that would look like.
Yeah. So we don't have that ability yet. But, you know, but if you wanted to do it, for example, from a big hospital to a rural hospital or something like that, that is possible if the technology is there. It is expensive technology, so that's one barrier, but that is a possibility. The other possibility for teleinstrumental assessments is to use asynchronous telehealth, which means, you know, somebody conducts the assessment in real time, and if they want a second opinion or another more experienced clinician to take a look and give them further interpretation, to store and forward it, or basically save it and transfer it in a safe way to another clinician for later review. So that's a possibility as well. There are billing issues there and complexities in that case, but there are ways to do those types of things. So I just wanted to make sure I touched base on that, because I realized I was talking only about two things, and I didn't want people to think, oh, she doesn't do instrumentals. That's not at all true.
No, we appreciate that. I think one question we had, kind of to back up even further from what we've been talking about, how do you figure out who is a candidate? Is everybody a candidate as a patient for teleservices? If not, kind of how do you figure that out? Or what are some questions a clinician should be asking themselves if they're curious?
Yeah, no, I think that's also a very good question. And it is also a very common question. And one thing that I tell clinicians is that, because a lot of people say, you know, what types of patients are candidates? And there's not really a good response for that question, because it's not about the type of or the diagnosis of the patient. It's really about a process of thinking of who could actually do this and benefit from this. And we are developing an algorithm that will be published very soon in SIG 13 Perspectives. So hopefully it will be available to many clinicians to see very soon. But in this algorithm, we're using a four-step approach. So this is what I'm thinking. So usually when I have a patient and I'm thinking, are they a candidate for telehealth, irrespective of their diagnosis, okay, or severity, I will first think about some very initial telespecific factors. So for example, do they have adequate enough hearing and vision and alertness to be able to attend a 30-minute, 45, an hour session, whatever I believe this patient needs, right? Are they able to be positioned in front of a camera for a specific amount of time so that I can see and hear what I need? And are they capable to consent, or do they have a proxy who can consent for them, you know, and go through the consenting process? So those are kind of the more general telespecific criteria that are true across different settings, not just for dysphagia, right? If the answer to all of this is yes, then I move to the next step and I say, okay, now let me see, do I have the infrastructure available? Do I have, especially at the patient's end, adequate connectivity and technology available? If not, could I get services that will give them the technology? So for example, just like you guys have AAC lending libraries, we're starting to have telehealth lending libraries with iPads and things like that that we give out to patients. If the answer is yes, then I move to the third step of the process and questions, which is now I'm asking about the clinical factors. Do I have all the materials I need to do what I need with the patient, or can I give them the material? Can I provide that to them? If the answer is yes, then I go to my last question, which is a facilitator available, able, and willing to help and to act in the case of an emergency? And again, this is not absolutely necessary at all times, but for dysphagia telemanagement, I very highly recommend it. And if a facilitator is not available, does that mean that the patient is not a candidate? Not necessarily. It will depend, as we said earlier, on age, medical status, cognitive status, and what is the emergency plan situation? Is something else we could do if a facilitator is not there, if an emergency were to occur? So it is a multi-step process that you have to think about, instead of thinking about this patient versus this diagnosis versus this age group. It's really more of a process. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, you already made the point, but just to sort of restate it, I think that so many of the things that you're talking about are applicable broadly when we think about telepractice in general. Like, these are, you know, the infrastructure questions that you should be asking yourself. You should have these things in place. You should have a way of assessing, you know, the hardware capabilities of your client. Like, just the very logistical pieces really do need to be ironed out before you even get to the clinical piece sort of at all. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and that relates to that preparation that I was talking about earlier. That's part of it. You know, you need to do possibly, you know, a 5 to 10 minute trial session. You need to spend that extra time. I understand it's not always reimbursable. You know, it's time and energy and all of those things. So I think another important consideration, and I think I talked about it, especially in the latest ASHA webinar. I think it is important for people who are really serious about it and want to make sure that they can use telehealth beyond the pandemic. They really need to think about, how do I fit this into my workflow? Because there will need to be some initial time and energy spent. But I think if you do that extra preparation in the beginning, and incorporate the use of telehealth into your workflow already, then it will be much easier to sustain it long-term and beyond the pandemic. I believe that people that don't want to use it anymore are the people that didn't do the preparation. They jumped into it very quickly because they had to, and they realized it's a lot of extra steps, it's a lot of extra effort, and they didn't want to be doing that every time because they didn't put the preparation time in and they didn't incorporate it in their workflow in the beginning. So it's all, I think, part of that preparation time.
Well, and I think too, you know, you've talked about your specific institution, but I think that, you know, that's something else to think about. It's just at the institutional level, if you're working somewhere, you know, can you recruit? Because some of this stuff, you could potentially allocate these jobs to other people and kind of divide the workload up a little bit. That makes it feel a little bit more manageable. Like, one person can come up with, you know, a bunch of sample bandwidth, you know, even exactly. just really logistical stuff. Like, is your bandwidth yep. this? Go on here and check it.
Yep.
And so doing that at an institutional level, I think it's probably...
Absolutely.
I mean,
we actually, for the testing of the connection, we had the receptionist in the clinic do that. You know, I mean, we trained them, we spent a little bit of time with them and said, this is what you need to do. This is what, you know, you connect, you go to this website, you check, you know, you ask the patient to do the same, you share your screen. You know, we shared some steps with them and they started doing it from then on. We had some graduate assistants do some other parts. So depending on where you are, and what type of help you can have, definitely you can if you have help, that's great. And you can definitely allocate. Absolutely.
And one thing that, you know, some people were concerned about was the extra time for the patient, but I've actually found that the patients that I have seen really appreciated that we took the time ahead of time to make sure that their connectivity was there, that they knew where they should be positioned, what equipment they should bring, and that they were given time to ask questions about how the whole process would work.
Yes, absolutely. I find the same overall. As I said earlier, there are always some people that it doesn't work for them, you know? And especially, I don't know about where in what states you guys are located, but here in Indiana, we had a little bit of trouble with some of the older folks. Well, not all of them, but, you know, with some of them. So that was actually a challenge that we had to address. So we had to create step-by-step instructions and, you know, and do more trial sessions with them and all of those things. And then after that, it worked much better. But overall, I feel like it's actually in the context of all the time that is allocated to a session from the patient's perspective, it's a time saver because they don't have to drive to the clinic. They don't have, you know, some of our patients drive from far away. So that's a big time saver and energy saver and money saver too. So I think they have appreciated some of those components as well.
I wonder if you could walk us through maybe a potential session just for someone who is listening, who wants to think, you know, we've got the lay of the land, the larger landscape, mm-hmm. the safety precautions, mm-hmm. some tips and tricks. But if you could go through a pretend session with us, maybe in sequence, I think that would be really interesting.
Okay, I'll try. So is it a tele-evaluation or a tele-treatment session?
Oh, gosh.
Doesn't matter.
You pick. Dealer's choice.
Okay. Well, the big difference is if it is an evaluation session and it is the first time or one of the first times I'm meeting the patient, I will have spent about 10 to 15 minutes before to train both of the patient and the facilitator on the safety plan. And it literally doesn't take more than 10 to 15 minutes for most situations. But I go through that because that's also part of the consenting process. And that's something that, you know, with training, probably a graduate assistant or another assistant could possibly do in another clinic. But in the beginning, I usually try to do it myself and the patients feel better that way. I'm also probably the fastest in doing so, going through that plan. It's a 2-page document. We go through it and we just say, you know, this is... I'm explaining the risks and the benefits. I'm explaining our qualifications to do this. I'm asking them if they're willing to do it after I explain everything. So the part of the consenting process. And then I'm telling them that just like any other medical procedure, there are some safety things that we need to talk about. So I talk to them about any safety concerns they may have about these risks. I answer any questions they have. And once they agree, after that, we're ready to start with a clinical session. That can happen right away, or it could be another day that is being planned. If it is another day, the only thing is before you start the session, you want to remind them, do you remember the emergency plan? What is it? What did we decide? Who's going to call 911? You know, ask some of those safety questions. Take 2 minutes, literally, no more than that, I promise. And then after that, and that's something you actually, we ask in the beginning of every session, eval or treatment, okay? And then after that is answered and we are set that everybody knows their roles in the case of an emergency, then we can start with the actual session. For the clinical evaluation, we start with an interview process, a case just like you would start in person in clinic, right? Usually they will have completed a form. So we use that form to go through the responses, make sure they're accurate, ask any clarification questions. And then we start with the cranial nerve assessment. Also, if they have done any other questionnaires, we will also go through those questionnaires as well. We will do the cranial nerve assessment, and that's the part where the facilitator will also be very helpful. Then we will do the oral trials, and then at the end, we will spend 10 to 15 minutes to kind of summarize what we saw. I usually record part of that session. I don't record all sessions. So you don't necessarily have to record session. Actually, it could be a breach of confidentiality if you record all sessions. So that's another thing that you need to check by state, you know, reimbursement agency and all of that and facility. But I do record some of the evaluation sessions because sometimes I'll go back and rewatch just to make sure that I captured all elements of the evaluation. But we spend the last 10 to 15 minutes to basically summarize what happened, what we saw. We usually tell them that we will tell them more things in the next session. If it's just an evaluation session, and ask if they have any more questions. How did they feel about this encounter? If there is anything we could change. So some tele-specific questions. And that's basically it. I don't know if I forgot anything. I probably forgot some of the cognitive screens and things like that we do. But those are usually part of the interview process in the beginning as well. And the treatment session is similar, but you know, instead of the clinical evaluation steps you follow, you go through the different instructions for the clinical, for the treatment. We do have a lot of materials that we have prepared that we screen share with patients. So for example, for the cranial nerve assessment, we have almost step-by-step pictures of what we want them to do. Now, of course, we are modeling it for them as well, but just in case they can't understand. Yeah. We have step-by-step instructions. We also have step-by-step instructions for the facilitator. So that's part of the preparation that has been done. So that's what that would look like.
One thing that I think is really unique about doing the assessment through telehealth is you're able to visualize what the patient is actually likely to be sitting in, what their positioning is going to be.
Yes.
So in different clinics that I've worked in, we've had, you know, very expensive therapeutic chairs with bands and pillows, and that's not realistic for most, if not all, of our patients at home. Absolutely. So it's good to have that as part of the process. So we can make sure that the patient is realistically going to be positioned appropriately. And if the positioning isn't working, it's really great to work with the caregiver in real time to troubleshoot that and figure out what we could do. Okay, could we bring in a box or a stack of board games or books underneath the feet to make sure that the patient is well supported? Or can we get some pillows for lateral supports? And I think that's just really unique to telehealth. I mean, also to home care, but thinking difference between a clinic, it's been really helpful, and families and caregivers have really appreciated that aspect.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Tracy. Absolutely. The you are in the naturalistic environment. And in addition to all those things that you mentioned that are very, very helpful, especially in pediatrics, I know we haven't talked much about pediatrics, but hopefully a lot of the things we covered also will be relevant to your pediatric clinical audience. But also the fact that, for example, especially in pediatrics, the other thing that I have found very useful is that a lot of the materials have to be prepared by the caregiver at home before. So they are the materials that they have available they would use in everyday life. They're not the materials that you just have in the clinic. So that's another way to generalize things much faster.
I agree. Also thinking about different cultural foods that people might have at home.
Absolutely.
That we don't have. One of the big complaints that I used to get was that people wouldn't eat chicken. And the hospital would serve white meat chicken. And a lot of countries in the world do not believe that that is delicious. And so at home, they're having the darker meat chicken, or they're having part of the leg or the thigh. And, you know, that's really different. Whereas, you know, I can't go down to the kitchen and say, no white meat, please. I would only like to eat chicken for my trials today. It's really great to be able to have that available. And also if we're, you know, working on eating crackers with a patient, but they're not eating crackers at home, then, you know, it's not really a useful goal to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we ask them to prepare like a list of items, a lot of times we will give them just examples of things that they have available. And it's I know the bad thing is we can't standardize across patients if they're each one is using their own thing, right? But the clinical assessment is essentially, of course, ideally you want to have as much standardized information as possible, and you can supplement that with standardized tools. But when it comes to oral trials, because food is such a personal experience and as such a cultural experience, as you said, I think it actually has been very helpful to see what the different patients can come up with and what they want to try and how they do. So yeah, absolutely.
In our last minute or two, do you have any words of wisdom if you could, you know, in reaching through the headphones to a clinician who is maybe just starting this clinical adventure? Do you have any last pieces of advice?
That's a pretty heavy question.
No pressure.
No pressure at all. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I would say that, you know, as anything else that is new, and requires a new skill, it needs time to be learned, but it's definitely something you can learn. And it needs time and investment, just like anything other new skill that you would like to learn. So I would just recommend making sure to spend the time. Nowadays, there are many resources available, many webinars available. I believe there are going to be more and more trainings available in the upcoming months and years on this. Finally, because of COVID, that was probably the silver lining, graduate programs are incorporating this in their, you know, in their curriculi. So I believe, you know, there will be more and more resources. So I think if somebody, and there are resources out there. So I believe that if somebody is really interested, they just need to be patient and give themselves time, and the investment of time and energy and money will pay off if they're very serious about it. At the same time, you know, I just want to reiterate that we do have research evidence. We're starting to have more research evidence under more naturalistic conditions. Because, you know, I do hear a lot, there's no evidence. This is unsafe. This is that. If you don't have the knowledge, this is what you think. You fear of something that is unknown. So I want to reiterate that there is knowledge out there. There are guidance. There are guidelines. And there is some research. So just do your homework and take the time. And one day I think you will be very glad you did that.
Those were wonderful last words. That was great. This whole conversation has been so wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. This was so awesome.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's great. You guys asked great questions and it was a great discussion. I appreciate having all of you here. Thank you.
Believe me, the pleasure is on this side of the microphone for sure. This was really great. If anybody is listening and would like to use this episode to earn ASHA CEUs, you can do so on our website, www.slpnerdcast.com. All of the resources that were mentioned will be linked in the show notes. So if you've listened and you want to learn a little bit more, dig a little bit deeper, read a little bit more literature, all of those resources are available for you in your podcast player or your phone or wherever you're listening. And we're so glad to have you today, Georgia, and hope everyone learned something today. So thanks again.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us in today's episode. As always, you can use this episode for ASHA CEUs. You can also potentially use this episode for other credits depending on the regulations of your governing body. To determine if this episode will count towards professional development in your area of study, please check in with your governing bodies, or you can go to our website, www.slpnerdcast.com. All of the references and information listed throughout the course of the episode will be listed in the show notes. And as always, if you have any questions, please email us at info@slpnerdcast.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to welcome you back here again soon.